Welcome to the Electric Monks Podcast. Episode 38, the original draft of Dirk Gently Reveal.
Hello, and welcome back to the Electric Monks Podcast. We are rapidly closing, and I say rapidly, I mean an episode every 6 months or 7 months or so on 42 episodes. My name, of course, is Edward Hunter, and alongside me is my co-host, Nemo. Nemo, how you doing?
Good morning, everyone. We are, I think, rapidly in the sense that we can only go forward. We can't go backwards. So on geological timescales, this is as fast as it gets. I'm doing well.
I'm pretty sure this is either episode 38, I think, yeah. Because I think the last one we did with Yvette was number 37, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, so there is not too many to go, but it could be a while before we actually get there, at the rate that we're churning these out. And I say churning in the most liberal use of the term. But wow, we have got some news that we should probably get to. And it's not just in our lives, but in the world of Dirt generally. So we've got some news about the animated series. So back in, I believe it was June. It was, yes, yeah, 7th, which is July, not June. So a month later, sorry.
Yes.
We got the email from Prodigal, which is, of course, Arvin Ethan David's company. This is sort of explaining a little bit, because apart from the random Reddit comments and stuff, we hadn't really heard anything about the animated series. That was the video I did back in January with a bit of speculation in there. But so the message reads basically as follows. So it says, Dirk Detectives, we know you haven't heard from us in a while. We're still working and determined to bring you a Dirt Gently animated series. We were in mid-process with the show, including having a wonderful actor attached in the lead role of Dirk Assistant, when, well, you might have read about the WGA and SAG strikes, which of course Writers Guild America and Screen Actors Guild. So we were running full speed ahead, and then we ended up stuck in a waiting game. We're standing in solidarity with the unions. Now, of course, since that message was given to us, the Writers Guild of America strikes, those have been resolved, but the Screen Actors Guild strike, they looked like they were going to be resolved, and now they've been opened up again, essentially because of issues. I think the Screen Actors Guild, they had a few hang-ups about AI, essentially, that weren't met in the negotiations with the studios. So that's ongoing. I'm not sure what the terms of solidarity are here, but it seems to be because they mentioned both unions striking that they're waiting for both strikes to end. And I believe even WGA are still supporting SAG, despite the fact that their, you know, strike is essentially over now. But yeah, so I suppose they're free to write a bit more, but they're probably their lead actor that they've hired, they probably can't use because they're probably an SAG SAG-AFTRA member.
Hello, Ed from the future here. Since we recorded this, the SAG-AFTRA strike has been concluded and resolved, although some people are not entirely satisfied with how the AI rights ended up being resolved. But nonetheless, the strike is officially over, so our information here is a little bit out of date, so apologies for that.
That was interesting. Almost the way it's written, it sounds like they haven't cast Dirk themselves yet, that it's presumably this Pearl character, whatever Pearl has morphed into in the last 2 years of writing, that they've cast, essentially.
Yeah, well, we know from having looked through so many histories of Dirk Gently that plans and characters can be rewritten and renamed and repurposed any number of times right up to the last minute. So, an assistant named Pearl from 2 years ago is... It doesn't tell us really much about who the assistant or the assistant character might be now.
We did see some concept art, so we know roughly whether Pearl ends up in the final product, whether the final product happens. Hopefully it does, because it seems like if it wasn't going to happen, Arvin wouldn't keep telling us that he's working on it every year or two. So hopefully once SAG and the studios finally sort of come to a more reasonable agreement from the studios in terms of AI rights, essentially, in movies and TV shows. And that's not rights for AI like Blade Runner or anything. I've just been literally using AI in terms of using actors' likenesses and stuff, and sort of not exploiting, you know, like an extra does one day on a movie and then their likeness can get used by a studio without paying them forever, that sort of thing.
Yeah, AI demanding rights themselves feels like that'll be a future strike. We're definitely not ready yet.
Computer says no.
It does make Robin Williams his contract that his likeness couldn't be used for however many years it was after his death. Fantastically prescient, basically. Like, I'm sure it wasn't written in context of reanimating his likeness through AI. It would have been through reanimating his likeness through more traditional animation, or using him in marketing of things that wasn't originally planned.
Yeah, and that happened because of Aladdin, didn't it?
Yes. He was screwed over pretty royally by Disney with that. But it turns out that contract, that clause in his contract, is going to serve him very well in this regard. I'm sure behind the scenes within Hollywood studios there is any number of AI versions of Robin Williams, but the use of that is absolutely not possible. Which is for the point of view of preserving his legacy, I think that's fantastic.
I thought you were about to say now, as it happens, Disney screwing over everyone. But
well, just Robin Williams.
Zelda Williams, by the way, Robin Williams' daughter, big Douglas Adams fan. Come to think of it, because I remember there was a thing where she wrote something like a quote from Hitchhikers as a X bio, I think, because Musk has changed the name of it.
But the company formerly known as Twitter.
I think she wrote, in the beginning, the universe is created. This has annoyed a lot of people and has widely been regarded as a bad move.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Yes. That rings a bell.
So yeah, the other thing Arvind mentioned, and this is an odd one, I have a feeling he sets up almost because of the strike. So he mentions two other projects. There's, of course, his escape room game that he's been working on, because he's obviously a big fan of escape rooms, and he's got one that's based around, I think, Mary Shelley, and I think called Mother of Frankenstein. Loads and loads of puzzles and stuff. So that's interesting for those that want to give that a go, because I think that's a big labor of love for Arvind. He's worked on for a few years, and there's also this is a bit weird, but so he sort of mentions he wanted to do a Douglas Adams audiobook Kickstarter to showcase Douglas's sort of humor in genius, new and surprising ways, and there was a pre-registered link to the Kickstarter page. When you click it, it just sends you to the Kickstarter homepage, so I assume it's been literally in the past week, actually, he's taken it down. So I had thought, because that was when the strikes were, we got news for hearing that the strikes were being resolved, so I wondered if is this Arvind sort of his project that he was doing to fill time, because he also, I think, had gotten some celebrity guests who are fans of Douglas to do some write-ins as well, that was using a lot of material from the archive. And I think Arvind told me a couple of years ago that he was working with the archive to do something, so that might have been this. But it does feel odd if the Kickstarter suddenly disappeared all of a sudden, or if he just did it just to gauge how much interest there was and then took it down. I don't know. It's
hopefully not the second. That feels a little bit cynical. But the timing with the strike does seem like it might have been a placeholder thing to do something that was viable while the strike's happening, because obviously the strikes are a good thing from a getting fair pay and everything point of view, but from a keeping practiced with creating stuff for creatives, it must be some level of frustration. And I was talking about this with a friend just the other week too, with regard to Colbert and The Late Show. And we were talking about, well, when the strikes end, they're going to have to do a catch-up of so much stuff. Are they writing those jokes now? Are they making notes? Are they drafting jokes but not finishing? Like, at what point, obviously, they can't publish them. That would be breaking the strike. But how much work behind the scenes to prepare themselves for when the strikes end can they do without breaking the strike? And I don't have an answer to that. I don't know what is appropriate. I don't know if it's per person or if there's a within the union, within the strike organizing, that there's a level of that. But I did wonder about that with regard to Colbert, and that obviously applies to anybody else involved with the strikes, including Arvind, that perhaps this this Kickstarter was something that was permissible within the context of the strike, that still allowed him to keep the creative muscles active and not atrophying, of doing something, creating something, even if it was perhaps not intended for final results straight away. It'd be interesting to see hopefully in the next few months, if there's any follow-up to that.
Yeah, and it would also make sense if he was back working on the animated series again, that might end up this... might end up being put on the back burner. And also, there's already a Douglas Adams podcast. You're listening to it right now, so get off our turf.
Well, there's a few Douglas Adams podcasts if we're really going to get into the...
Wow. If we're going to get technical about it.
This is going to sound terrible as a podcast host, co-host guy, but I'm not really a podcast listener. But I'm aware of a few Hitchhiker podcasts, one that was going through... alphabetically all the places and names and people and events and whatnot in Hitchhikers, and
it's of course our friends from Hitchhikers
and Appetizers, yes, which is
they're in their final season at the moment as well.
Yep. That's a podcast that's effectively fan fiction. It's improv set within the Hitchhikers world. They hang out in booth 42 of Milliways and interview people from all over the galaxy and universe, and indeed other universes. And get paid for it, because that's a loophole that they found in the guide financial systems. They don't have to go to places, they just have to interview somebody and submit an entry, which is a fantastic premise for their podcast, and it works. There's a lot of fun in that. And I know, obviously, Hitchhikers gets mentioned. There's quite a number of podcasts where Hitchhikers has had a one episode themed, like, let's look at all the sci-fi over the years. Do a Trek episode and a Star Wars episode and a Babylon 5 episode and naturally a Hitchhikers episode. That type of thing has occurred a few times. But yes, we obviously are a Dirk Gently podcast with We are a Dirk Gently podcast, but we're very expansive about what we talk about, and there's lots of Douglas Adams and Hitchhikers in our content as well. So yeah, are we a Dirk Gently podcast that talks about Douglas Adams, or are we a Douglas Adams podcast that focuses more on Dirk Gently? Nobody will ever know.
It's up to you to your interpretation. one of the things I've been thinking about is maybe we should go back and watch a couple of these while doing a few rewatches of some of these Dirk shows. We could probably do like commentaries and record them, and maybe do those as a little bonus episodes for people. I'm not sure people
that's would actually pretty cool. Yes,
be interested in that. We can even get the Heart of Gold people involved, because I know you guys do rewatches sort of there as well.
And, yep. Yeah. Yeah. A rewatch and commentary, because I think there's fan made commentaries to things. If there's not a style of podcast dedicated to that, then there might be sites dedicated to people doing that, or
it's not a totally original idea. You're right. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's been done, and it's been done both seriously and humorously. The humorously most famous with Riff Tracks, which was a spin-off from Mystery Science Theater 3000, I believe.
It was, yes. Similar people involved.
Yeah, some of the same people overlapping that. And Riff Tracks, if you've not heard of it, this is to everybody, but also to you, Ed, directly. If you've not heard the Riff Tracks to the Star Wars Holiday Special, it is the only way to watch the Star Wars Holiday Special. It is unwatchable with the original audio. But when you're listening to a couple of comedians poke fun at how bad it is, it becomes, I'm going to say, tolerable. Not sure I'd ever...
My brother and his friend watched it the other day, actually. And then a few days later, we went to Brighton to watch The Room together, as me and my dad and my brother. And we actually, the guy from the Room, Greg Sestero, actually appeared and did a Q&A as well. And I bought a Blu-ray of The Room, which is quite hard to come by in the UK, off of him.
I've not seen The Room, but I really should one day.
Absolutely. The feared is the only way. Again, it's another one where the only way to get through the free sex scenes, I think one of which recycles footage from the first sex scene, is to be in a theater, because there's also, when it ends, somebody in the audience chanted, "Oh, thank God." It's just quite a funny experience. And there's also all the repeating location shots of San Francisco, and everyone's like, "Meanwhile, in San Francisco." And it's a nice little just cut from one scene, show the Golden Gate Bridge, and then just cut back to the same scene. No, nothing's changed at all.
Movies where you get that level of callback and unintended audience interaction is fantastic. Like, I mean, Rocky Horror obviously is the famous one for that. And I enjoy Rocky Horror, but I think I've seen it maybe two or three times, not in a theater with callback settings, and it's fun. But in a theatre callback settings, it's hilarious. It is fantastic. It's just like, yeah, watching it without that, it's just like, I'm only seeing half the movie. I'm only having half the experience. The experience of having everybody know the lines and call back and enhance the dialogue by filling in the gaps with new dialogue just makes it so much better.
There are a lot of people as well at that theatre in Brighton who've seen The Room for the first time, and I think they definitely enjoyed how bizarre it was. Even when anyone sees a spoon in the background, because there's a story with the making of The Room where they were decorating the set hurriedly, and all they could find were, instead of pictures of like a fake family or something, they just put in pictures of spoons. So whenever a picture of a spoon shows up, people pick up spoons and start throwing them at the screen. So by the time they did the Q&A at the end, Greg Sestero is sitting on the chair surrounded by plastic spoons on the floor, which is quite a sight. But it's almost tradition at this point with The Room. And also there was something here, because it was 20 years of The Room, of something he asked us to do in the screening, which is where near the end of the movie, Tommy Wiseau's character, because obviously he writes, directs, and stars in the film, has a massive breakdown and decides to destroy his apartment. And he goes to a chest of drawers, he pulls out the first chest of drawers, go one. He pulls out the second chest of drawers, go two. Then he gives up and pushes the thing over. So say, fuck it. So that was quite funny, just to perform together in the theatre doing that. That's the sort of thing that you wouldn't really get watching. Even though The Room, I still think, is so bizarre and weird that you can still enjoy watching, I don't know, the version on YouTube with the sex scenes edited down that someone put up to make it slightly less awkward. But I think it loses something, actually. I think there's part of everyone having to sit through and the really embarrassing early 2000s R&B that plays over those sex scenes. I feel like the movie loses something without that, but maybe I'm alone in thinking that. But it's certainly an experience, to say the least. Anyway, I think there was one other news thing that we really got to cover before we move on, and that is Kevin John Davies' book. It's finally come out.
Yes,
42, The Wild Improbable Ideas of Douglas Adams.
Yes, that Kickstarter was a few years ago. I was one of the backers, and I believe the original intended publication date was in September 2022, and it was delayed by a year with COVID and Kevin COVID lockdowns in general, which limited his access to the resources. And I believe, though, don't quote me on this, that Kevin had COVID himself, which slowed down things.
I think he was seriously ill.
He was seriously ill.
Hello, it's Future Ed again here. Sorry to interrupt once more, but Kevin John Davies revealed early this year that in 2022 he was suffering from Hodgkin lymphoma, a rare form of blood cancer. So he has recovered from that successfully, which we're really, really glad to hear. But that was part of the reason why 42 was delayed. But Nemo is also correct. I think Kevin was also suffering from COVID at one point, as a lot of our listeners may have during that rather difficult time. But anyway, back to the show.
But you're right. Yeah, there was certainly a lot of delays, and we had to wait a long time to get it. But I think having read through the whole thing, I think personally it was worth the wait. I really enjoyed a lot of the insights in there. There's lots of stuff that I had no idea. I think some of the most interesting bits in it are actually some of the really, really early stuff about like Douglas's school days and like essays and stuff that he'd written. Like there's one that is, I think, quite early on that's about like a about like a sort of a playboy writer or something who dies way too young, and it's sort of, I think Kevin said that he included it because it sort of, there's a kind of eeriness, and it sort of matches up oddly, even though it's talking about, I forget if it's someone who's real or someone made up, but it's it has a sort of eerie similarity with Douglas's own life, I guess, and there's all the sorts of interesting documents from even dating back to like Brentwood as well. The other thing, and there's lots of things written by friends of Douglas who knew him as well, these sort of letters to him, some of which, all of which are really moving, I think, and some of them actually are quite revealing, actually. And one of the ones that I found really interesting, because it answers something that I wondered about for a while, and that was actually Dirk Maggs's letter, where he mentioned some of the stuff he did, you know, obviously because after Douglas's death in this letter, because Douglas obviously wasn't around to see it. He talks about having adapted the first two books of Dirk Gently, and he says that he was going to do Salmon of Doubt, and he said, I'll read the quote from it. He says, "The Salmon of Doubt series wasn't made when I parted with the production companies." That was above the title, obviously, because he then formed Perfectly Normal Productions. "I felt failed to behave responsibly towards creative talent. I learned later that your agent, Ed Victor, withdrew permission for them to make it without me. I'd still like to have completed the trilogy, but I hope you agree Ed made the right call." So I sort of assumed, I knew something had kind of happened, but I didn't realize that he failed to behave responsibly towards a creative talent. It's an interesting thing, and I sort of get why Dirk sort of bring it up in this, because he feels like he has to sort of explain. Obviously, you know, it's a book for to read, but also the letters have a kind of personal element to them, in that obviously Dirk, like I said, Dirk's talking about all the stuff that Douglas, you know, wasn't around to know about, and there's a sort of feeling that he has to sort of be honest about why he left, because for a long time Dirk Maggs sort of left and then never really elaborated too much, I don't think, in public about why he did so. Just that, oh, there was a whole thing that happened. I think people just call it, bizarrely, the Kim Fuller affair, even though Kim himself claims never to have been involved or written anything for Salmon of Doubt.
So, yeah.
Because it was reported on the time that the BBC had done a deal with Kim and his agent, even though...
Yeah, and you got to wonder where that came from, like with Kim's historic...
Stage magazine.
Somebody wrote that originally, and did they misread some scrap of information about Kim Fuller being linked to Dirk Gently, which historically was true, or were they trying to find a headline and deliberately created information where there was none, or was it a genuine mistake? That's the unknown here. But getting back to Dirk Maggs parting with the production company. And the production company not behaving responsibly towards the creative talent, that kind of Ed Victor then withdrawing permission just feels like the natural follow-on from that. Dirk Maggs is going, look, you guys are not doing things I don't want to put words into Dirk Maggs's mouth, but I'm paraphrasing. He's effectively saying, you're not being ethical, you're not behaving appropriately, I'm going to move on. And Ed Victor, who by all reputation was a great guy, taking a similar view, and no doubt if Ed Victor wasn't aware of these issues with the production company prior to Dirk Maggs leaving, then Dirk Maggs leaving would have absolutely raised flags of, this is something to investigate, and who knows if Ed Victor and Dirk Maggs spoke about the reasons for Dirk Maggs leaving. It seems reasonable that they would have spoken, but that's, I want to be clear, that's 100% speculation on my behalf. Ed Victor following the same path as Dirk Maggs took of considering the production company not treating the creative talent well, whatever other issues may have been behind the scenes that we can only speculate about, and I'm going to try and avoid speculating in any detail.
Do you think it's a shame, though?
Yeah.
Given that Arvin's got the rights now, obviously since Ed has, you know, sadly passed away, that he couldn't do a deal with Dirk Maggs to sort of finally give us that Salmon of Doubt series.
That would be interesting.
It would be, yeah, especially now that Dirt Mags has even done And Another Thing. So there's no more Hitchhikers to do. The only way would be to do Salmon and sort of make it a which it seemed to be gearing up to be, a sort of Dirt Gently Hitchhikers crossover with, you know, Dirt some meeting kind of for between them. The party in Islington. So
yeah.
But there's and it's interesting because the other thing I noticed listening back was there's a lot of stuff in here, particularly in the section on Dirt Gently in the book, and there's a section with a whole, but there's a section on Salmon, which is very interesting because there's a lot of like different story ideas that Douglas writes down, and there's also other bits that he's crossed out, which are literally just Douglas writing about things that going, the sort of him going out for a meal and what annoys him on this meal and sort of stuff where he's writing just to either to sort of just get some thoughts down because he thinks it's helpful, or he's just really, really frustrated because obviously we know how much he struggled with writing and deadlines. And this is a book, Salmon was his only book that never really had a deadline. So that sort of clearly freed him up to sort of, you know what, you'd sort of think not having a deadline would make things easier. But if anything, it sort of makes things a bit harder for him. And I think what's written in here does sort of support that. But some of the interesting things in the notes are, there are lines I recognize because Dirk Maggs then put them in the audio series into earlier bits of the story, essentially. So there's a bit in here, a very, very short bit here, where Douglas has an idea for, it just says, on visiting a restaurant, and then there's lines of dialogues. It doesn't say who they're from, but it says, imagine the finest, the most delightful meal you've ever tasted. The other character says, yes. And the first character says, and keep thinking of it. It may help sustain you through the horrors of the meal you're actually about to eat. Now, I recognize this because in the adaptation that Dirk Maggs did of Detective Agency, this is what Reg says to Richard at the dinner, because the dinner serves the same old sort of stale soup essentially every year. Reg knows this because he's been there like 800 years or whatever, and the thing that slightly annoyed me is that I read this line and thought, wow, this is really good, because there's something I'm writing at the moment for Kim actually, this also has a scene in a restaurant, and I thought this would fit really well there, and then I wrote it down, listened to Dirk Maggs' thing, and then realised, oh, Dirk Maggs has already used this. So I felt a bit stupid after that. But yeah, there's lots of really, really very interesting things. I do want to talk about just a few of them, but the section on Detective Agency I think is probably of particular relevance, because obviously it's the first book in particular had a lot of stuff that was changed. Obviously, yeah, like going right back, there was an interesting, a really interesting thing I found, that if you remember the 2005 Hitchhikers movie, one of the things in there, and I think this is an idea, this impetus came from Douglas himself to repurpose this, the stuff about the point of view gun. Yeah. This is originally a really early idea for Detective Agency, actually, from dated in 1986. So that was really interesting, because I never would have guessed
really
that.
Dates it back, yes. And we know that Douglas liked to reuse his ideas, and there's endless evidence of that, the obvious being the Doctor Who story ideas, City of Death and Charter, both contributed elements to what became Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. But there's other evidence. If you look at the stuff that he wrote with Graham Chapman, Out of the Trees and Our Chauffeur Ringo, both of those, I'm pretty sure Out of the Trees at least, has sketches that reappeared in some form in Hitchhikers. Our Chauffeur Ringo included an earlier version of Space is Big, Really Big. You wouldn't believe how vastly, hugely, unimaginably big it is. That predates Hitchhikers, and it's such an iconic Hitchhikers line now. So it's absolutely on par for Douglas to dig through his earlier ideas and repurpose them. And the point of view gun, I know the movie makers said at the time, or have said since, or maybe it was Kerry Kirkpatrick who did the final polishing of the Hitchhikers movie script, that the vast majority, or perhaps even all of the original ideas in the movie that hadn't been seen elsewhere, did stem from Douglas. Knowing the point of view gun was Douglas's idea is not a surprise. Knowing that it came from nearly 20 years earlier as a Dirk Gently idea. I definitely didn't know that. Hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah. And also the other thing is that it's gone the other way around too, where the Electric Monk was originally, according to Kevin's notes here, he says that the mug stain note above, which of course says high on a rocky promontory overlooking a green valley, sat an Electric Monk on a bored horse. It says, this is where Dirk Gently began. A random, intriguing line jotted down on a piece of paper that Douglas would rediscover and further ponder. The line was originally intended for a continuation of the Hitchhiker's Guide storyline. Obviously, that would have been pre-Mostly Harmless, though, 92, and post...
Yes.
So long, thanks for all the...
There's a interview, and it's on... YouTube/Twitter/wherever else it's been that the BBC has shared it to. I think it's on one of the BBC archives accounts. It's an interview of somebody, Douglas Adams, and Jeremy Paxman is watching from the background. It's a little bit of a weird interview layout. And Douglas is specifically asked about the introduction of the book with the monk, and he says in that interview, which is mid-80s, that he had most of Dirk Gently story plotted and then came across this line that he didn't remember writing and immediately felt like it belonged as part of Dirk Gently and reworked the character of the monk into the book, and that line became the opening of the novel. I haven't read this part of Kevin John Davies's 42 book, so I'll have to track that down. I've got the book next to me. I've just not gone through it in detail yet.
Yeah, I want to keep it in near mint condition.
But reconciling that interview with these notes will be interesting to see. But I've always felt that it would be very interesting to see what the pre-monk version of Dirk Gently was like.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the next things literally in the book after that is a draft press release from 1987, which talks about an earlier version of the plot of the book, and the monk is mentioned exactly nowhere.
Yeah.
So that does very much support that. I could read some of you like the sort of very basic story premise that Douglas has written here. Okay, so it's Dirk Gently's detective agency. Half of the logo, this early logo, also seems to be a very faded image of half of Douglas's face. It's a very weird thing. I think I better post this on the Dirk Gently subreddit as well. And it says, Dirk Gently's detective agency /... Douglas Adams. What it is, a ghost/horror/detective/ time travel/ romantic comedy epic. Vitally important background stuff. The story begins many, many millions of years ago, before the first spark of life ever appeared on this planet. 10 minutes before, to be precise. The last remnants of an embattled and evil race, the Straglaxians, have landed on a barren young planet to build a vast refuge for themselves. Their ship is crippled. They take a finely calculated risk in trying to restart the ship's engines. Against huge probability, the risk fails, the engines explode, the ship and its crew are blown into gamma rays and send a pulse of energy into the rich primeval slime, triggering the beginning of life on Earth. So already we have a name change for the aliens. The Salaxians are the Straglaxians in this version. And of course, there's no monk, so instead of just trusting the Electric Monk, the repairs are done. There's a finely calculated risk, apparently, that doesn't pay off. So I actually think the monk, them trusting the monk, is actually somewhat more darkly comic than Douglas' original idea. But anyway, the gamma rays come back in the next bit. So it says, meanwhile, a large number of millions of years go by. The world we know and recognize emerges. An odd world, some would say. A world that we, its inhabitants, have continually peopled with imaginary gods and devils to explain the inexplicable. And there seems to be an awful lot that is inexplicable. Among the things that we find that we most constantly try to explain to ourselves are death, guilt, evil, a persistent sense of loss, and headaches. Now, Dirk Gently is, as he is fond of telling his friends, of whom he has many, some of which he has kept for as long as a week, a professional charlatan. He makes a living by having silly ideas, and then finding people stupid enough to believe them. His current one is Dirt Gently's List Detective Agency. As a result of a popular science book he read recently, he has decided to try and apply the principles of quantum mechanics to the finding of lost pussycats. His fear is that they are not lost, but that their waveform has temporarily collapsed and must be restored. This is, of course, complete tosh. At least it might as well be for all the cats he finds. And Douglas has written a few notes as well on this press release. Like, I think he's written a probability. It's weird because it's in a sort of diagonal sideways weird font. These handwritten it. It says, instead, in the course of the story, he stumbles unwittingly on a force that has powerfully interfered with and haunted life throughout human history, which is the collapsed quantum waveform of the very strong probability that in primeval times, the Stranglaxon's ship engines did not explode. Like all waves interfering with other waves, it has peaks and troughs, times when it is very powerful, times when it is very weak. When it is powerful, it causes a huge increase in violence, irrationality, and paranormal activity as our world passes into the grip of the Stranglaxon ghosts. And then Douglas has written, are the ghosts in some way generating the probability wave as a way of retrieving the situation? Clearly, there's a note of him trying to figure out what his original. I think he wrote earlier the Stranglaxon's evil, and he's put a box around evil. He's like, evil? Are they? Are we sure about them being totally evil? And it says, at its most dangerous, it takes possession of people, makes them the puppets of an evil race lost in time. And then he writes, Matthew Winkworth, and he's already underlined it and then written Richard McDuff, ? So already he doesn't like the name of his main character. Matthew Winkworth is a man with a problem, which he makes the great mistake of confiding to Dirk Gently. His problem is that he has left a message on somebody's telephone answering machine about which he is now extremely embarrassed. It was just asking Eve Bairstow out for dinner with the prof, writes Douglas. But he made a complete mess of talking to her machine and doesn't want to appear a complete fool at this early stage of what he hopes will be their relationship. What to do? Gently proposes a very simple answer. Break into the house. Wipe the tape. So that is interesting because it's definitely not Dirk's suggestion in the final book.
Yes. There's a lot of ideas there that got reworked into familiar forms, but not how they're presented in that draft press release.
Yeah, oddly enough, of the characters, the one that feels the most similar, the most fleshed out, is Dirk himself, and maybe Matthew Winkworth, literally just without the name change, he's basically Richard McDuff already. But the next page has details on some of the characters, of course, starting with Dirk. So it says, some characters, Dirk Gently. There's a long tradition of great detectives, and Dirk Gently does not belong to it. There are those who say that he hardly belongs to the most minor tradition of human beings, but the only people who say that are people who know him, which leaves a good 3.9 billion people who have no particular reason to loathe him yet. And that itself shows how much the population has grown since 1987. A typical Dirk Gently bill to finding cat deceased, £50. Detecting and triangulating vectors of interconnectedness of all things, £150. Tracing same to beach on Bahamas, fare and accommodation, £15,000. Strolling on in the face of draining skepticism from client drinks, £327.50. Which I think is exactly the same figure that he quotes in the final book as well, £327.50 for struggling on in draining skepticism from client, in face of straining skepticism from client. I'm slurring my speech slightly, that's bad. Then this is interesting. The next character mentions is Dirk Gently's manservant. Believed by Dirk Gently to be the smallest, ugliest man who ever lived, and often used by his employer to break the ice at seances. He is cantankerous, willful, goes completely insane at weekends for relaxation, and usually refers to himself as Mr. Gently's creature. He's also known as the Nameless Horror, or Nameless for short. And the other thing is, in his notes for Salmon, Douglas brings up this character again, so it definitely seems like he intended... Maybe if he'd finished Salmon to formally introduce this Nameless One character, because he writes some dialogue for him, a conversation between him and Gently. He also writes a story about the Nameless One being in a fight where his back it's fixed in the middle of the fight, and he briefly feels this inexplicable joy. so that sounds interesting. Next character, this will sound like a familiar character to you, Joystickly, Dirk Gently's lank and rat-like girlfriend. Of course, we know in the final book, this character was reworked to be Janice Pierce, who's not particularly short on rat-like, and not Gently's girlfriend either. This is secretary. But,
employee, but employee is a little bit questionable.
Yeah, you do get the sense from that description that this Joystickly that the character would not have an entirely healthy relationship with Dirk either.
No.
That does make the BBC Four series decision to have Janice have the love-hate relationship with Dirk have some sort of... It feels probably completely coincidental that Howard Overman has written something that's actually kind of similar to Douglas' original idea for that character.
But, yeah.
I think probably having as the secretary was probably the less egregious version. I think the Dirk Maggs version is probably the best version of the Janice-Dirk relationship, that it's a bit more sort of odd couple, almost like father-daughter in a way, the father of a very, very distant and annoyed daughter. It's this vibe I get from the radio series. We have Matthew Winkworth, of course. A computer software designer who does not deserve the things that happen to him in this book.
That's very Richard.
He's very Richard. I feel like Richard ends the book. He kind of gets what he wants by the end, eh? He does have to go through a lot of blackmail and from Dirk and being hypnotized and jumping into a canal before then as well. But we also have Samuel Taylor Coleridge, well-known romantic poet, drug abuser, and unwitting stumbler upon sensitive architectural plans. It's interesting that Coleridge was clearly a part of the plan quite early on.
Yeah. Architectural plans. That's very curious.
Yeah. Presumably for the aliens. Well, might not be for the aliens, but that feels really, really real. And it's one of the things we'll never know the answer to because Douglas is no longer here to explain it to us.
Yes.
And that's all he says in this press release. We also have the Regius Professor of Chronology, the final one at St. Ed's College. Or Reg for short, a kindly old duffer, widely thought to have been brilliant in his day, though no one's quite certain as to when exactly his day was. A minor character to begin with who begins to assume greater importance as more facts come to light about him. For instance, Matthew Winkworth discovers that he appears to have been living in the same set of rooms in college for over 300 years. The nature of Cambridge academic society is such that no one has seen fit to call attention to this. Reg is in fact a retired time traveller. It is through his intervention that our heroes are eventually enabled to fight a battle to the death in the primeval swamps of Earth. So you can sort of see how that relates, because this is sort of a mix of Sharda and City of Death. So Reg as a character is pretty much there already as well.
And that's confirmation from
not in the final book as well. That he's a retired time traveller, which is of course lifted exactly from Sharda, but never confirmed in the book, because obviously Reg, they didn't have the rights to use all the Doctor Who stuff.
The book just keeps it super vague, where he came from. Also interesting that this version, Matthew Winkworth, Richard Macduff character, is said to discover that he's been living in the same set of rooms in the college for 300 years, whereas in the final book, this is just something that Reg admits without very much prompting.
Yeah, it's kind of a non sequitur. Yeah.
He's just like, I've been living here since forever, and I don't even know how old I am. And the nature of the college is that nobody asks about these kind of things. It's kind of works out well for me. Which matches actually really well with the description here of a kindly old duffer.
Yeah, the other thing I thought also interesting is that Eve Bairstow is a obviously meant to be Susan Way. There's no Gordon in this version because there's no monk to kill him. Matthew Winkworth is in the early stages of the relationship with Eve Bairstow, whereas in the final book, Richard and Susan have been dating for a while, and Richard has proven himself to be a bit forgetful and unreliable. I think either version could have worked in that instance, but again, it's one of the ones where Douglas has drawn it to be a bit closer to his real life, I think, because he wasn't he in a relationship with his future wife at that time? Was it Jane Belson, the lawyer, when he was writing Detective Agency in 86 and 87? I'm pretty sure it was around about that time that he was writing Dirt Gently that he met his future wife.
Yeah. I think that timeline makes sense, but I'm not sure. I wouldn't put money on it.
There's a thing that Douglas wrote for retailers to sell the book, but Douglas writes, "Dear bookseller, when I wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books, I was only mucking about, really, seeing if I could get the typewriter to work. Well, it did, all except for the letter B, as anyone who reads them carefully will quickly realize. Well, this time I decided it was time to really get down to it, roll my sleeves up and do the job properly. What the world needed, I could see quite clearly, was a thumping good detective ghost horror, whodunit, time travel, romantic musical comedy epic, with a decent cookery supplement at the back. Well, it's not going to get it, I'm afraid, because I'm a lousy cook and always manage to burn the spinach, but I think I've managed to cram the rest in. I would like your help in this. In the past, I've seen The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy displayed under Travel, and The Restaurant at the End of the Universe featured next to Egon Rene and The Good Food Guide, and this is a trend I would like to encourage. There is no section of a bookshop in which Dirt Gently's Detective Agency will not happily sit, and from which it will not, I hope, disappear pretty smartly too. Except for the cookery section. Please don't put it there, it will only confuse people. Wait for my next book. My publishers are begging me not to call it Dirk Gently Makes the Perfect Spinach Soufflé. But they're going to have to buy me a lot of lunches if they want to change my mind. I've really enjoyed writing this book, more than any since my first one. I hope you enjoy selling it. Good luck with it, Douglas Adams. Portrait of an author who just finished his new book at 4 o'clock in the morning. And it's a very tired-looking picture of Douglas in front of his bookshelf. That is interesting, because, of course, he signed the two-book deal. So for all people reading this, they might have actually fully expected the booksellers to... that Dirk Gently Makes the Perfect Spinach Soufflé. It would have been the next style instead of Long Dark Tea Time. There was one other thing. Apparently, another thing that Kevin writes is in his early notions part of this chapter is that Long Dark Tea Time concerned itself with the fate of the Norse gods. Douglas had played with this notion in the early 1970s in a mockumentary script about Zeus. So there's a short thing there. So that is another interesting thing of Douglas recycling ideas again. Although, of course, in that original version, it was the Greek gods. But I think that sensibility has certainly carried its way through into Tea Time, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think I've covered pretty much everything that I found interesting from the Dirt Gently specific section. The rest, you'll have to read for yourself as I hopefully drop the book onto the floor and no doubt have made it worth £50 less than it was.
I dug my copy from the box that it was sitting on the couch next to me, and was reading along for some of that, and was just distracted by reading the very next page was the Kubla Khan poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, famously cut short, as is core to the plot of Dirk Gently's Solicited Detective Agency, and Douglas wrote an extension to Coleridge's original. Not a long extension, not quite doubling what was there, but reading through that is going to be interesting to see if that provides extra ideas of what the Dirk Gently story ended up being, because obviously the contents of that poem was very important relative to how the story progressed.
It was, yeah, and I always mistakenly seem to remember, and it might be because I think we do hear a little bit of it in the Dirt Mags radio series, but I've mistakenly misremembered the second and weirder half of the poem as it's described in the book as all being like instructions on how to repair the Silaxian ship.
I think that's the implication in the book. I know in the... in that opening part of the novel, that it does say that it's the second and much longer half. So it's not exactly what Douglas is writing here, because his second half is shorter than the first half. I will be paying attention to the possibilities of it providing ideas for the Dirk Gently novel and what eventually happened with the plot there when I do find time to read this from Kevin John Davies's 42 book, which to give it another plug, because it is an excellent book for the bits that I've dipped in and out of it so far, which has been far less than I should have, given that it's been sitting on my couch for several weeks now, and that I was a Kickstarter backer, and everything about it has looked excellent. It's finding time. as is always the way of these things.
Absolutely. Look, we barely find time to do this, do we?
Yes.
And speaking of time, that's all the time we've got for this episode. So we hope you enjoyed the review of the 42 book, and also specifically the Dirt Gently parts, but also this general news discussion as well. So next time we're going to be looking at religion, belief, and mysticism in Dirt Gently thematically. So we're going to talk a little bit about Douglas's own life and views on religion and how that influences work. And the first part is going to mainly be devoted to the two books, and then part two is going to be looking at the two television series, of course, that came after Douglas's death, and sort of their approaches to religion, which are both very, very interesting indeed. But anyway, thank you very much for listening to episode 38 of the Electric Monks podcast. And just a reminder, you can go to our website, dirtgentlypodcast.wordpress.com, and find us on Anchor as well, or any other of your apps, and give us a review if you so feel like you enjoyed it. Or if you didn't enjoy it, then just don't say anything, which most people do anyway. But anyway, we hope to see you next time, or hope you hear from us next time. Thank you very much for listening, and bye for now.